Affairs meeting to order. It's March 17th. It's 1:37. Members present are Senator Lincoln, Senator Elton, Senator Taylor, and myself, Senator Wagoner, Chair. Let's see. We have back in front of us Senate Bill 38.
You want to adopt the new
committee? Yes.
Did I move that the committee substitute that be taken up, which is Bannister 31703? I believe that's the S version at the top. Is that the one you want, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Okay. I'd move that that be the document before the committee for discussion.
All right. Have now before us CS number 38, dated 2/25/03. Is everybody?
Mine says
317.
Maybe I got the wrong one.
Yeah, 225 was the original. I think.
This is Senator.
Oh, the one with the
yeah
amendments on it. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, 317/03. All right, now I have before us that Senate Bill number 38 is amended. Questions? Committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Lincoln?
Is the intent for the sponsor to explain this or what?
Yeah, we're going to have the sponsor speak to it. We've got the draft questions in front of us. We even have some answers back already from the Alaska Professional Design Council. And this time, if the sponsor would like to come forward to speak to the bill as amended. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The CS that you have in front of you deals with a couple of issues that were discussed at the last meeting. Changes the delay period from three years to 2 years for a transition term. This is in the renewal period for mechanical administrators. This would allow all mechanical administrators time to get proper training when a new code is being adopted. And that's not just, that's not up when you're updating a set of codes. It's if you switch from one code to another, there'd be a delay. But rather than the original proposal of a three-year delay, it would be 2 years. The language also clarifies on the bottom of page three that the delay period is only to apply when there is a complete new code. Does not apply to, and does not apply to the initial adoption for the Department of Labor. As if we give the Department of Labor this authority, they would have to implement a set of codes. There's no delay for that initial set, but then, therefore, in the future, anytime they propose going from one set to another, there would be a delay to allow the training to go on. But just for your average, your normal updates of the codes, there would be no delay. So that's basically what's contained in the CS. The larger issue of whether all the codes should be put into one jurisdiction over the oversight of one agency is still out there. I haven't come to any conclusion in my discussions with the administration. It's my understanding that they are working within the agencies to try and come up with a suggestion on how to answer that question. I'm not sure exactly where they are in that process. So, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I guess I'd leave it up to you today whether you want to continue to hold the bill until this committee can consider that, or you could choose to pass the CS out. It would go to Labor and Commerce next, and they would be able to continue to work on that. I'll leave that up to your call.
Question? This time we'll take testimony from people online. For those out there who testified last time, if you have something to add, fine. Otherwise, your testimony is on record. Doug Mathers, are you there? Go ahead, please.
I have no comment at this time. I'm just wanting to listen in. Thank you.
All right. Is there anybody else online?
There's an op-ed. Colin Maynard.
Who?
Colin Maynard.
Colin Maynard, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. My name is Colin Maynard. I represent the Alaska Professional Design Council. And I haven't actually seen the second committee substitute, but from my understanding, it's pretty much the same as the last one. And therefore, we would oppose it. We don't believe that the mechanical code belongs in the Department of Labor, belongs with the Building and Fire Code. There's been a lot of confusion because of the name change by ICBO from the Uniform to International Code.
Sorry,
they're the same people who've been doing there. Mechanical code for the last 40 years in the state of Alaska. And we don't see any reason to change. There was one question about whether the Department of Public Safety had the legal authority to adopt a mechanical code. Well, they've been doing it for as long as I can remember. So I would hope they would have had legal authority to do so. At any rate, we would believe that a task force approach would be much better, deal with all the codes at once rather than piecemealing the process and coming back next year and maybe changing this whole thing around again. Thanks. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Any questions? No questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next is Steve Scholes.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Scholes, and I've been a construction inspector.
Go ahead, Mr. Scholes.
For local government, state government, and federal government for over 25 years. I'm speaking today as a private Alaskan citizen. I'm certified by all the agencies who write codes, both the international, the uniform, IAPMO, and ICBO. And I didn't testify last time. I was out of state. I wanted just to give you my comments on where we are today. Both of these codes that are being discussed are good codes. They're slightly different. They both have their biases. But I was pleased to see the language take out the discriminatory language that would not allow the international codes to be adopted in the state. They're used by 45 states in this country and jurisdictions within them, and over 50,000 members. So they're certainly a long track record and a valuable document. There is a bias between the two codes. The international family of codes and the way that they're structured have a public safety, health, and welfare bias that is very evident, as opposed to the NFPA's process, which favors industry and trade organizations, those with a vested financial interest. So keep that in mind as you deliberate on the merits of the proposals before you. A discussion of public safety versus labor. I think if one looks to the municipalities in the state, you'll find a common thread, not only in Alaska, but governmental agencies throughout our country. A one-stop shop, if you will, where codes are seamless, they're integrated, they work together, people communicate, so that the building construction industry and the health and safety of our residents is at the forefront. Alaska, in my opinion, has a fragmented approach to construction regulation that doesn't work very well. And we could learn a lot from municipalities. Hopefully we could support their efforts and try to emulate them where they make good sense. And that is to have communication and consistency among all the regulations and keep in the forefront the purpose. The purpose is fair, impartial regulation to everyone involved in the process and public safety. In Alaska, we saw for over 15 years organizations that had this legislature hold the 1979 Plumbing Code as the state document regulating that activity and trade. It cost us tens of millions of dollars a year, all of us, to administer an outdated code that financially benefited those people who sold those expensive materials and spent more hours on the job installing them to the detriment of their fellow Alaskans. So with that, I'll close. Thank you very much.
Like the record show, that Senator Gary Stevens has showed up with us now. And are there questions? No question. Thank you very much. Anybody else here in Juneau wish to testify at this time? I think we've got some more online testimony. You got some more? Oh, no? That's all the testimony?
That's correct. No more.
Senator Lincoln.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then I've got a couple questions of the sponsor.
Okay.
Senator Turia had to leave, but I can answer any questions you have.
For the record, my name is Zach Work. I'm staff for Senator Turia.
I missed the last meeting where this was discussed, and I know that Fairbanks had a concern, or I guess was opposed to the piece of legislation, and since there have been some modifications and amendments to it, could you tell me what Fairbanks' position is at this point?
The building officials there are still opposed to the legislation.
And remind me again what their major opposition was.
Senator Lincoln, through the chair, it's their opposition is, first of all, for the time lag in the effect, or for when the code would go into effect. That's one of them. The second one would be that they have gone through the process of updating their codes to the international codes. So first of all, it would require some more work for the local municipality of Fairbanks.
And some work, what in the sponsor's discussion with Fairbanks, what would that require as far as time frame goes?
Senator Lincoln, they would have to go through and update the links between the International Fire Code and International Building Code with whatever code the Department of Labor would adopt. If they would go through and adopt the uniform code or the international code like the Fire Marshal's Office did, then there would be no additional work. But if they were to switch to the uniform code, they would have to go and get the links and synchronize the two codes.
But isn't that what this two-year, the amended version on the delay of the application was for, the training and to get it updated by Fairbanks?
Senator Lincoln, through the chair, the delay would not affect the initial code adoption by the Department of Labor. It would affect all additional or any future code switches for when, say, the Department of Labor or the Department of or the Fire Marshal's Office were to switch to an entirely new brand of code. That's the only time this two-year delay would come into effect, when they switch to an entirely new code, and it wouldn't be affected on the Department of Labor's initial adoption of a code.
And Mr. Chairman, if
Senator
I might, NANA Colt Engineering was also in opposition to this because of the moving from one department into the other and their concern. Have you or has the senator spoke to that particular group of opposition?
I've spoke with Mr. Moore a couple times. I guess I don't understand your exact question, though.
Are they still opposed to in this format? Okay.
Senator Lincoln, we have two groups of people who are basically on the opposite side of an issue, and it doesn't sound like they're going to ever agree on exactly where we should go, except for I think they all agree that the codes could possibly be in one place, and that would solve this problem from happening again.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Lincoln.
The other question that I've got is more for this committee, and that is the sponsor of this legislation said that what hasn't been resolved is the jurisdiction. that still needs to take place in this this piece of legislation, and whether it be this committee or the next committee that needs to address that, I don't know what your thought is on that.
My thought is I'd like to move it out of this committee and move it on. It goes to Labor and Commerce next, and let them deal with that. In the time since we had these hearings last, my thought was to put this whole thing under one department, and specifically I was thinking over in occupational licensing, but I guess there's been some people say that that's not the place to go either, so that's just a thought.
Senator Wagner, I could possibly speak to that. They, from my understanding, is occupational licensing doesn't have the, I guess I don't want to speak for them, but from my understanding, don't have the ability or the technical knowledge to do it. They deal mostly with training and licensing of these trades, and don't necessarily deal with the exact codes. They can authorize a class under a code, but are not 100% on the codes. We have spoken with some people within the administration, and they have stated that they are in the process of getting the Fire Marshal's office to sit down with the Department of Labor, with the Governor's office, and address where these codes should be. Because each side obviously wants them in their department, and it's somewhat hard to find a third department, a neutral department, where these could be placed.
And nice to have that discussion before we had the bill for us.
Yeah, that's what I was.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification. In response to Senator Lincoln, you said the building officials in Fairbanks are still opposed. I mean, it's also fair to say that the mayor and the city council are still opposed, not just the building officials.
Senator Elton, through the chair, I believe that most of the people that are writing the letter, like you said, the mayor, are speaking on behalf of the building official there.
The city council did pass a resolution opposed to them. Okay. Just a comment, Mr. Chair, and I recognize that, you know, I'm kind of tugged in two ways. I mean, I could care less if this remains in front of us, but I guess my feeling is that I think there's work to be done. I think we don't know what the administration's position is on this, and clearly there are substantive questions and issues that have been brought up. And I'm just kind of uncomfortable, I guess, at this time with the notion of moving it on prior to getting some feedback from the administration and prior to it seems to me, especially the Alaska Professional Design Council letter and the issues and the questions they've raised, I think there's still some substantive issues, and I feel somewhat guilty about passing those issues on to somebody else.
Senator Taylor?
I have to echo some of that, because I think the critical aspect of this legislation is not necessarily which code is going to be adopted, or even the fact that we have conflicts within departments right now, or turf battles, as has often been expressed. I think the critical issue is the issue of jurisdiction, and that the final determination on this bill is really not going to be whether we allow for a two-year phase-in or three, or details of that type. I think the critical policy call to be made by the legislature is what department, what area, as you've suggested, Mr. Chairman, maybe occupational licensing should be given consideration. Is it appropriate at Department of Labor? Is it more appropriate to, as we had suggestion and testimony in the previous hearing, that all the codes ought to be sitting with the Fire Marshal's office, too, that maybe they're the better arbiter of these disputes. I'm very swayed by the testimony of the gentleman that came forward today and talked in terms of having continuity and one-stop shopping, and I think that's critical to both the design professionals and the building trades. And that's why I'm troubled also that I'd like to have that issue of jurisdiction resolved, and we've already put in, you have especially, Mr. Chairman, considerable time on this matter, and rather than just dump it off on another committee so they can start from what basically is ground zero on the jurisdiction question, I think there's been good attendance and a lot of interest by the panel in this one, and I'd commend you to hang on to this thing for a little while. Let's make some decisions here on policy as to what jurisdiction it's going to be, so that when we send it on, we've got a pretty good product for the next committee.
Further? Well, hearing that, then let's just go ahead and hold it over until we hear back from the governor's office and the Department of Labor and the Department of the Fire Marshal's office.
Just one other thing.
See if they can solve the problem.
Yeah, for the record, would you call for either objection or a vote and then declare whether or not we've adopted the CS? Because I brought the motion, but we never went through that.
I'm sorry, you're right.
Into discussion.
Because I had the wrong one from me. Is there any objection on the motion for the committee substitute? There is none. All right.
We're adopted.
Go see the governor. It's in his lap. That was good. Okay.
To the Kodiak House.
This isn't like Freddy Krueger, is it?
I hope not. But it's a lot like Groundhog Day, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Gary.
I have a glass of water, too, Gary, now, if you would, please.
A little martini or something?
Yeah.
Boy.
While he's up.
We lost our audience.
Have you got a blender? Oh, you've got the important part.
Still here? Yes. Not sure the favorite department, but...
Oh, I don't know. People. She's I was going to say, that's very well put. Let's see.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Here. Gary, we need to...
Next bill before us is Senate Bill 118. And at this time, I'd ask Commissioner Ballard to come up and give us her take on this bill, and then we can discuss it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ernesta Ballard, the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. We don't come to your committee very often. I'm here today to present to you and answer questions you may have on Senate Bill 118. I have with me Kristen Ryan, who also has a dark green suit on. We did manage to get green on today.
I'm part Irish, and I had a little green alligator my grandson gave me, and I forgot to put it in my pocket.
Well, I think your staff is taking care of that. There's plenty of green glowing at the back of the room there. In any event, Kristen will stay on to answer questions. I do have another appointment, but I'll be happy to answer whatever general questions I can, and I have just some very brief opening remarks. Senate Bill 118 is the governor's legislation, which we hope you will approve, to allow first and second class boroughs to enforce food safety standards. The state of Alaska has been ensuring that food is handled correctly since statehood. State law provides the framework, and the department's regulations provide the standards that protect public health. We are fortunate that in this area there's been a growing knowledge of food safety handling practices and modern preparation, food preparation technology in recent years. And in fact, in the last 20 years, many food safety programs have implemented new regulatory approaches to take advantage of this new body of information. Among the states, generally, a mix of local health districts, local and state governments perform the needed tasks to ensure the public food supply is protected. Alaska is unique among the states in that state government has been for a long time the only and recently the primary regulator of food service establishments to protect public health. The state has had statutory and regulatory ability to delegate this program to local governments since 1999, and Anchorage alone takes advantage of this opportunity and conducts their own food inspection program, food safety program, as a home rule municipality. In fact, Anchorage has done that, I believe, since its incorporation many, many years ago. We believe that it's important to encourage as much local control as possible in the important area of local food safety. State law allows home rule cities and home rule boroughs and first and second class cities to implement a food safety program that is consistent with their charter and approved by their assembly. This bill will provide the same opportunity to first and second class boroughs. Specifically, it will allow those boroughs to conduct a food safety program using protective state standards. The state of Alaska will continue to set protective standards through the Department of Environmental Conservation and to implement them in areas that have not asked for a delegation to provide the services themselves. This legislation does not require any local government to take on this responsibility. It gives them the opportunity to exercise this local control should they choose. And as I said, Kristen is with me today, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have about this.
Okay. Are you going to leave now?
I'll stay a few minutes,
Senator,
if I can.
Taylor?
When the questions get too technical, with your permission, oh. Mr. Chairman, then I'll leave.
All right, Commissioner. We'll remember that.
Aquatic farming, are the cities in any position to take on that testing that would be necessary? Because it says aquatic farm products.
Senator Taylor, through the chair, a municipality, a local government could theoretically take on those powers. They would have to demonstrate to the state, as is the case with any delegation either from federal or to state government or from state to local government, they'd have to demonstrate to our satisfaction that they had in place a program that was sufficiently funded with sufficiently skilled personnel to take the delegation, and then they could. This is a theoretical delegation. I mean, this sets up the opportunity.
Okay. And are there, which I would encourage, I think that's probably great, should some of the municipalities be willing to take that on? It'd be wonderful if they did, at least especially down here. We wouldn't be shipping everything clear to Palmer right now. But what about air pollution? Are there any cities that are actually doing it? Is Anchorage doing it? It says air. I mean, that's part of the existing law, and I was just surprised.
Senator Taylor, through the chair, Anchorage does have a fairly extensive capability that is, again, specifically delegated through the department to handle aspects of their air pollution program.
And if someone didn't want to go into food inspection, which is the primary thrust of the bill, would the department still be able to delegate or require them to go into it?
Senator Taylor, through the chair, this is not a mandatory program. This is an optional program. The state will, through the department, continue to implement a program which is available statewide that will assure that any place in the state without a locally delegated program has an adequately protective food safety program.
Thank you.
Senator Lincoln, and then Senator Gary Stevens.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. That was somewhat of my question, too. If this is not mandatory, and with the funds being as they are for the federal money coming to the state money going to municipalities and cities, what's the incentive for local, for the boroughs to assume, especially on the food inspection, and take on that liability? What's the incentive for them to do that? And was this as a result of boroughs coming to us saying that they would like to resume those that role?
Senator Lincoln, through the chair, two different questions. Let me answer the first one first, which was, what is the incentive? I think it's a sort of a matter of basic civic principle that government likes to do for its people as close to the people as possible. And there are many local governments that choose wherever they can to provide services directly to their constituents. Food safety is one of the oldest government programs in the country, going back 100 years or more. And I think the tradition, the sanitarian's tradition, is one of the proudest in the country. And I believe there will be local governments who will seek this local opportunity to deal directly with their restaurants and food preparers. If they don't choose to, the state will continue to provide a protective safety scheme. The second part of your question was, what was the incentive for the governor proposing this bill? And I'd say there's a sort of a double-pronged incentive there. The first is that, you may recall, this issue has been debated in previous sessions. And in the last appropriation bill last year, the legislature specifically directed the administration to reorganize the inspection program for those boroughs that were large enough to conceivably cost-effectively run their own program. Even without that direction from the legislature, the process of food safety management in the country has moved beyond the rather conventional program that the state of Alaska has, which is an inspection-based program, and has moved beyond to offer incentives and major program components that work with operator certification, operator management systems, to get more responsibility and accountability placed with the operator of the food establishment. And we in the department believe it's time for us to move in that direction anyhow. In other words, it's time for an overhaul of our program to take advantage of the best regulatory practices that other states have taken advantage of in the last 15 to 20 years. So summarizing that rather long answer, I think we probably would have moved in this direction anyhow. We certainly take seriously the language of the last appropriation bill.
And the final question to that is, if the boroughs take advantage of this and take the assumption or the inspection for food and products, aquatic farm products, how much of a savings would that be to the department, and does that save you a position if the boroughs did that?
Senator Lincoln, through the chair, the governor's budget proposes a reduction of, is it six positions, Kristen?
Yes.
Five. Oh, you came closer to me. Creeping up. Six positions and an attendant reduction of just over $500,000 of program receipts. That is in anticipation of the four largest boroughs assuming responsibility for their own programs. That program reduction is a reduction specifically of the inspection program that we are now providing in those large boroughs. It is fully supported by restaurant fees. The restaurants pay the fee, and we provide the inspection service. Those boroughs would then presumably, as does the city of, or the municipality of Anchorage, charge their own fee and run their own program. We have sufficient funds remaining in the governor's proposed budget for the department to reorganize and implement what we believe will be a protective statewide program without that component of the program. So this particular piece of legislation is best looked at as a companion to the governor and the department's proposed budget, which is a reorganization of the program that we've got and an elimination of the components of that program in those four large boroughs that was the inspection component. It doesn't eliminate our responsibility to set standards that are protective and to use other tools available to the state to achieve a protective program statewide.
Senator Stevens.
Well, Senator Lincoln must have been reading my notes. So just to follow up that a little bit more, if I understand this, well, first, as a former rural mayor, I like those things when the state said you can choose to do it or not. It's an option, and it's not something mandatory. But it does appear to be a wash. I mean, the fees you collect pay for the personnel you hire to run these programs. So is that true, I guess? Is it a wash? Is, in fact, the fees collected, does that cover the costs of hiring staff? I'm not sure about the true cost savings to the state. I think that's still a question that I have out there. Truly, what does the state save? And then finally, a question about seafood processing plants. Is that totally excluded here? Always gets me a little concerned when we say aquatic farm products, and maybe we could slip over into seafood processing as well. But could you just comment, Commissioner, on those issues? Do the fees cover the costs? Any savings to the state and seafood processing?
Okay. Senator Stevens, through the chair. Do the fees cover the costs? The restaurant fees cover much of the cost, but not the entire cost of this program. The program must, at the broadest state responsibility general fund level, determine what the right approach should be to food safety inspection and what the standards and what the basic framework of the regulatory program would be. The proposed budget reduction is, to the best of our ability to tease out, the actual cost of implementing the inspection program in those large boroughs. So is there a real savings to the state? The state budget includes, in its gross sense, all program receipts. And so there is a reduction in those program receipts and a corresponding reduction in the positions and the expenditures at the department level.
And if I could interrupt before you go any further, Chairman, I guess really I was focusing more on the boroughs, that if they take the boroughs take this over, will they see a cost? Will the fees cover their expenses? And if they don't, why on earth would they ever do it?
Well, Senator Stevens, through the chair, I would think you'd want to ask some of the boroughs that. As I said earlier, I believe that many local governments prefer to have a regulatory relationship in these types of matters, whether it's fire code, building code, food safety code, that those are functions that local governments often are proud to provide in direct contact with their own constituents. I recall, and maybe Senator Elton would recall, a number of years ago, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, that when Juneau was confronted with the need to do some smoke detecting out in the valley in the winter when you had inversions, some of the animal protection officers were trained to do some of that work. And that was a cost-effective way to keep people employed year-round. It worked well, as I recall. It was an innovation in local government delivery of services. And that one simply comes to mind as a way that a local government tried to cost-effectively deal with public health protection. I can't speak for boroughs about whether they would or would not choose to do this. I think Anchorage is very pleased with their program. They're able to have a stakeholder relationship which is more satisfactory to them than having the state provide that program for them. As to whether or not there is a savings to the state when the total state budget is reduced, whether it be through program receipts or general fund, it is in fact a reduction, and this is a reduction in state employment. And I think, again, in broad theory, it's generally assumed that when you reduce state employment, it does have a net beneficial effect in overall cost control, because you have fewer telephones and fewer people in the hall and fewer waste baskets to empty. So I think there is a true savings. It's not an enormous one, but it is definitely a budget reduction. The final question,
Before we get to the final question, I guess my concern is if the borough, for example, my borough, were to say they were to take it over, they would not have to establish the standards. You would have established the standards. So that cost is already taken care of by the state. The standards, the quality standards for restaurants, they would not be in that business. They would be enforcing state regulations, I assume. And I think I've looked into this in the past, that looking at just the borough, that the borough's expense of providing that inspector is, I believe, fully covered by the charges they make to the restaurants for those inspections. I believe that's the case. And I guess that's what I'm trying to get at here. If that is true, if it's false, or maybe we don't know.
The borough would have to, excuse me, Senator Stevens, through the chair, a borough choosing delegation would have to decide how to structure their program, it would have to, in our opinion, the department's opinion, be as protective as our program. There are many ways to achieve protection. Inspections is one, but not the only way. So they might choose an operator certification program. They might choose a food worker safety card. There are other tools that a borough could use to achieve a program, which Kristen's staff would then review, and if in their judgment the program proposed by the borough was protective with whatever set of fees, it could be, as our program is now, an inspection fee charged to the restaurant, whether the restaurant's inspected or not. It could be a per-visit fee. It could be a license fee or a permit fee annually or on some other schedule. There are many ways to put a regulatory program together. Our job would be to determine whether a proposing borough had designed a protective program. Their job would be to decide whether to combine it with the Animal Protection Division or to combine it with their Building Inspectors Division. They would have choices about how to put a program together that would work best for them.
And, Mr. Chairman, you used the term operator. What was that again? Operator
program? Operator certification program.
What does that mean?
That would mean that the food service operator, the restaurant owner or operator, might be required to have a personal certification that could be arranged either through us or is available. There are a number of independent providers of such things. There is a lot evolving in the country now in this area. It's a moving target of, I think, improved flexibility in delivering. The incidence of foodborne illness is not going up. It's probably at least holding its own or going down. The proliferation of restaurants in the country is so significant that it's a little hard to tease out statistics. But certainly we're on the right side of the power curve with this. There are good ways to protect people by moving accountability closer and closer and closer to the restaurant operator and further away from the command and control regulator. And we believe we and the restaurant operators and the boroughs and municipalities in the state are ready to move forward into a more contemporary regulatory regime.
Senator Elk.
And finally,
there was another piece to his question.
The question okay. on
and it was,
secret processing plants, will you maintain that
yes,
responsibility as a state?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Senator Elk.
Commissioner, thanks. I was kind of listening, and I may have just missed it, but the question that Senator Lincoln asked on whether or not any first or second class boroughs have asked for this delegation of authority. Are you aware of any that have asked for this delegation of authority?
Senator Elton, through the chair, no, I'm not.
The second question, and I've got, I think, only three, Mr. Chair. I'll do them one at a time.
I've only got one, will you give me?
But it seems to me that what we're doing is we're inducing some kind of cross-jurisdictional issues. And, for example, I'd be interested in what, you know, the owner of a McDonald's franchise or a Denny's franchise or a Domino's franchise would think when they have a different food inspection regime in different parts of the state. It wouldn't seem to me that that would be business friendly.
Senator Elton, through the chair, that's exactly what they experience everywhere else in the country. We're actually unique in that we're probably the only state in the union that maintains a statewide food safety program. The majority of the states, and I'll use Washington State as an example of a sister state right next door, have actually local health districts that are smaller units of government even than local government. And the local health districts are generally organized within counties. And these kinds of responsibilities generally accrue to local health districts. So a McDonald's might have, what would you think, Kristen, 30 jurisdictions in the state of Washington with whom they deal.
So it would be intuitive for us to assume that they prefer our system where they only have one jurisdiction.
Senator Elton, through the chair, I'm not confident that that would be a good intuitive judgment. I think that at a restaurant chain like McDonald's probably has their own food management safety system that they operate uniformly McDonald's-wide and probably has a higher standard than any state or health district could hope to achieve. So my guess is that for large national chains with large potential liability, I think it was Senator Lincoln who brought up the concept of liability, they are their own best protectors.
And kind of on the cross-jurisdictional issues, Mr. Chair, how do you deal with, or do you deal with food service on cruise ships or ferries or other other food service providers that move from jurisdiction to jurisdiction?
We do not with the cruise ships. Do we inspect the ferries?
Yes.
Yes, we do. So yes and no. I was fortunate, excuse me, Senator Elton through the chair, I was fortunate enough to be at a cruise ship conference just a few weeks ago talking about our cruise ship legislation, and the entire morning was devoted to the Norwalk virus outbreak. And I sat in because I am the state sanitarian, so I thought, well, I was here to talk about water pollution, but gee, I'll talk about this. And there I was impressed by what I've just told you my guess about McDonald's would be, and that is that every one of the lines that was present and reporting had a food safety management program that would be the envy of any state. They had different levels of alert. They had different levels of operator requirement. They had different levels of food handler sanitation requirement, and they were all on red alert all winter. And you know, we could only dream of inspecting to achieve a result like that.
To follow up, Mr. Chair, would you envision on the ferries that Sitka would be responsible for a ferry inspection, Juneau would be, Ketchikan would be?
No. Do you want me to have Kristen? I'm inching towards the door, except I just moved to the wrong side.
The wrong way.
Kristen, identify yourself. Well, this is fun. I'll stay for a while.
My name is Kristen Ryan. I'm the director for the Division of Environmental Health, which would operate the Food Safety and Sanitation Program, the new one we developed. We currently, right now, there's many operations that operate across jurisdictions. One would be the railroad, another would be the ferry system, and our intention has always been to we would maintain those oversights even if the jurisdiction in that area, that borough, took it over.
Mr. Chair, my final question, for now anyway, would be, there are entities out there, and I'm thinking of school districts now, mm-hmm. in which there has to be a license inspected food provider before they can get federal dollars. Mm-hmm. Who would handle that, especially in the unincorporated areas? Would the department continue to do that?
The restriction that the restriction that I'm familiar with says that it just has to be a government licensed entity. So therefore, a local jurisdiction would qualify.
But there are some local jurisdictions, because of the permissive nature of this, I doubt in CHEVAC, mm-hmm. that they're going to be assuming food inspection powers. I mean, would the department then
have to tax continue to do that?
Yes. Senator Elt, through the chair, yes. We would maintain it everywhere that hadn't chosen to do this on their own.
Okay. Thanks.
That was four. You said three.
Did I? Okay. One of them was a follow-up.
I'm going to take privilege of the chair and ask my questions now.
Yeah.
Just a little comment first. When I was mayor in Kenai, although we were a first-class city, home rule city actually, the borough maintained the zoning powers. And we asked the borough to transfer those zoning powers to us on a permanent basis, which of course they couldn't do, but they wanted to. So they did. Then borough mayors changed, and the new mayor said, well, maybe we don't want to do that. Are we going to look at this maybe with the state, change of administration, since it's something the state can allow the borough to have but not necessarily permanently allow? Are we going to be looking at that or the possibility of that? I see the lady back here shaking her head, but I'm not sure of that, because I know governments work in strange and mysterious ways.
Mr. Chairman, I cannot speak for boroughs, and I cannot testify to the likely stability of borough forms of government, but I'll repeat what I said earlier. Anticipating that the regime of food safety regulation is evolving and that it's time for Alaska to evolve with it. And I mentioned some of the components that I think we're going to see in a better regime. More operator accountability, more management system as opposed to one-time inspection, more opportunity for self-certification. We intend to develop a statewide program that will be protective statewide regardless of borough activity, because we believe it's the state's responsibility to assure that there is a standard of safety available. And the example we use in our office is at Pepe's and at Ruth Ann's. And, you know, we just want to be sure that we're in Barrow and in Craig, and then let borough governments choose to use this tool or not use this tool in their relationship with their own constituents. It's really, at that point, a matter for them to decide what kind of a regulatory program they want in their own communities. But we need to be sure that Senator Lincoln's constituents, as well as the more urban constituents, have at least the same baseline level of protection.
Okay. The only other thing I would request, we're going to hold on to this bill until the next meeting, but the one thing I would like to request, a accounting of the receipts in each borough that could be involved in this legislation as to what the receipts that you collect at this time are for these services. I understand what you said earlier about the positions and the I think it was $500,000 you mentioned on the receipts, but as we all know, sometimes in a office there are clerical duties performed perhaps by the state out of a different budget from time to time to support somebody who's doing some inspections or something. I just want to see exactly what the breakout on the dollars would be.
Very well. Okay.
Senator Taylor.
I've got a couple. Second Class Boroughs, as I understand it, is an organization put together with the limited power of taxing for educational purposes, right. Period. That's it. What
it would require a vote each for the time people to assume the power.
Yes, each time it requires a separate vote, or they can lump them all together. Put them in, but it just seemed odd that most of the second-class boroughs that I'm aware of, they were reluctant to even go in and start paying for some of their kids' own education. So asking them to take over something may be a bit much. But that's more of a comment than anything else, but it is something that probably we need to think about a little bit. I don't mind doing either one of these things. I think it's wonderful to have those opportunities available for the communities. I'm just concerned as to how many of them may opt to do it, because I can remember when we passed a bill around here 4 years ago that would allow every community out there that had a harbor to rebuild their harbor. And unfortunately, what we said was, we'll reimburse you for the cost of it. You guys go get the bonds. Well, just having the communities go get the bonds was too big of a hurdle for them. They weren't going to spend a dime of their own money to repair those harbors. They wanted us to pay for the cost of the bonds and the cost of everything else, give them a brand new harbor, and then they'd think about taking it. So I think many of us are concerned about that. It's a great gesture, but will they take it on? Will they do it? And if so, how many? Will you really accomplish your 6-person reduction?
Senator Taylor, through the chair, there are 4 boroughs that we believe are large enough to cost-effectively take on this responsibility, and they are Juneau, Kenai, Mat-Su, and Fairbanks. And we formed that judgment by counting the number of establishments that they have, and it is the inspections for those boroughs that in total generate $513,000 worth of annual fee income and require 6 inspectors. So we're not anticipating that others would become involved in a locally run program, but the legislation would allow it over time and with a change in municipal structure.
The only other question I had, and I'm very pleased to hear that, and I hope that they will take that responsibility on, because at least in those four boroughs, something will be inspected. The problem we've had in the past was was the last administration jacked the fees up clear out of sight, but then never showed up to inspect anybody. And my concern was, if you've got a restaurant in a municipality that or a borough that has not opted in, they're going to pay their fee to the state. But isn't that fee part of the licensing? I mean, isn't it required for licensing that you show that you've paid that fee? I mean, in other words, do we do the accounting here? Do we pass through? Or will a restaurant in Anchorage, let's say, buy its business license from the state and then pay a separate inspection fee to the city where the maybe the person at Cantwell would pay a business license to the state and a separate fee to DEC? I just need to know how that
Senator
works.
Senator Taylor, through the chair, I'm going to let Kristen explain the Anchorage fee structure and then the relationship between a business license and the present program.
Yeah.
Senator Taylor, through the chair, the fees currently paid, for example, in Anchorage go straight to Anchorage. Anchorage collects the fees from those restaurants. I'm not sure if they get, they must get a business license from the state, but I don't know if they get one from Anchorage as well. I don't know. I don't think they do. I think just the state. So it's a separate fee structure. That's how I would anticipate it would exist with other boroughs as well. We would step out of the business. I mean, we would back away. We would not be charging any fees because we wouldn't be doing providing any services. The borough that took on this project would have to determine how they'd want to establish a fee structure and collect those things and sponsor the program. And as Commissioner Ballard has explained, we're not sure if it would be inspection-based or some other form of program.
What I'm getting at is you're going to have within your department a geographic map of each of these boroughs and their boundaries and where that particular business is located as to whether or not you need to have them on your inspection list or their, and fee list, or they need to be on someone else's. And that was my concern, is that some areas, everybody's used to sending their fee into DEC right now. They've been doing that. We go to the change. That's going to be based on a geographic designation. Mm-hmm. You fall within a catchment area for inspections or you don't. And whether or not we would wash the money through the state back to them or whether, otherwise I'm not quite sure how you can be assured you've got everybody, you know what I mean, or that they have, that we haven't lost people in the cracks.
Senator Taylor, through the chair, the challenge you describe is a real one. I can't think of a department, however, better equipped to handle it. As all of you know, through our municipal grant, municipal loan programs, through our coordination of LEPCs, through our oil spill contingency response planning program, we have extensive and daily and intricate financial relationships with virtually every level of government in the state and every community in the state. And while it sounds like a complex challenge, it's part and parcel of what our business is.
Senator Elton.
Just a couple of follow-up. Thanks, Mr. Chair. What happens, I mean, if local governments, Kenai or Juneau or Mat-Su, say, make a decision at the local level and opt not to provide this? I mean, it seems to me kind of what I'm hearing is that the state has the option of saying, well, we're not going to do it for you. I mean, even though this is permissive, it seems to me that the ultimate goal is to have local government do it.
Senator Elton, through the chair, I think earlier in my testimony, I acknowledged that there were many forces colliding at one time on the food safety inspection program, some being initiated by the legislature in the very clear language in the last appropriations bill, and others being initiated by ourselves in common sense what-ifs, just like the one you've raised. We've done enough what-ifing to say, here's what we need to do. We need to step back, revise our program, be sure we have a statewide protective program, and allow local government to do what it chooses without dropping the safety net anywhere. So we understand that some what-ifing can lead one to conclude that there better be a statewide program that doesn't violate the legislative intent of the appropriations bill that said we don't want you in the four larger boroughs doing inspections. We heard that. That caused us, I think, to take a very refreshing look at the entire program and say, if this program was offensive enough to generate the kind of pressure that resulted in that appropriation language, then let's look at where it was failing. And I think Senator Taylor has hit on some of those places, that restaurants weren't seeing inspectors, there wasn't an apparent logic, and the safety net looked like it had some holes in it. So we've taken advantage of the opportunity presented by the language in the appropriations bill to say, what can we do statewide with the resources we have? And we have good resources for this. This is not a tiny effort. We've still got 30 or 35 people in this department or in this program. And we are revamping the entire program to be sure that without inspections in those four boroughs, we still can offer an assurance to the public of a food safety program that is protective.
Which gets to my second follow-up question, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that we're creating a situation, if in fact the four boroughs that you have mentioned do adopt a food safety program, that we're creating a situation in which the cheaper, easier to inspect restaurants, kind of the cream, are being taken out, leaving the department with more expensive inspections. For example, you take Bullwinkle's out in Juneau. I mean, that's okay because Bullwinkle's is easy to get to, but Horse and Colt Island now has a food service provider that is part of a whale watching tour. I have a lodge owner in Idaho Inlet who is now griping about 15 different permits that he has to get, who, if in fact you have to inspect his food service component, you're going to be losing an awful lot of money unless you up his fees to pay for that, simply because you no longer have the cheap, easy things to kind of even out the more expensive ones.
Senator Elton, through the chair, we are not assuming that inspections are the only or even the best way to accomplish food safety. And in fact, the lodge owner whom you describe may never have seen an inspector. And yet that lodge owner, if he's in business, has probably achieved a very remarkable record in food safety. He has a higher calling, believe it or not, even than the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, and that is his sense of responsibility to his customers. And if I can provide him the tools, which we are doing now through plan review, one of the permits he gets is a plan review from us. We help him assure at the time he sets up his kitchen that he has constructed his kitchen in a way that he can easily wash and sanitize it, that he has adequate food preparation separation areas, that he has three sinks so that when he's using a sink for food prep, he's not also using it for dishwashing, and any number of other things. We are providing tools and resources to him that set him up and get him ready to go. What we believe we can do is to extend our relationship with him through the internet, through the telephone, through passing on best practices, so that we do not depend at all on an inspection to achieve compliance with state standards. In fact, the majority of the restaurants in the state of Alaska have achieved a remarkable food safety record without an inspection, because the budget we have now does not allow us to be in all of those restaurants on any kind of a regular basis, and yet we have delivered a good program through training and relationship building with these operators. We would like to institutionalize that part of our program and minimize the dependence that we have had in the past on inspection.
Senator, it seems to me, I may be misunderstanding here completely, but it seems to me, first of all, this particular person is probably not going to want to talk to you on the phone or on the internet anymore than he or she already has. But it seems to me that what you're saying is that person is going to have it better than Bullwinkle's, who will be inspected. I mean, it seems to me you're setting up now a two-tier system in which the remote person is going to be operating best business practices kind of out of sight, out of mind, but Bullwinkle's here in town is going to have a more difficult
recipe to meet.
Senator Elton, through the chair, that's not what I said. Juno, if Juno takes, is Bullwinkle's here in town? I thought they were in Anchorage.
Oh,
there are Bullwinkle's here. You know, the Prospector Hotel is all I know now. but if Bullwinkle's in Juno, if Juno does not assume a responsibility for a food safety program, then Bullwinkle's will get the same tender, loving care as your remote operator will from me. If Juno chooses a program, they can choose a mix of regulatory tools of their own choosing. Juno may choose an inspection program. They may choose a plan review program. They may choose an operator certification program. There are many tools which effectively achieve food safety.
So inspections are not required?
Of whom? By whom? Excuse me.
Restaurant inspections are not required?
They are, Senator Elton, through the chair, what I am saying to you is we are reviewing our food safety program to determine whether inspections should be required and whether inspections are the best way to achieve food safety protection. Our record speaks for itself. Our record demonstrates that the majority of the restaurants in the state of Alaska have achieved a good food safety program without ever being inspected, because we have not fulfilled even our own department goals in realizing inspections. That's been regularly reported. That's no surprise to the legislature. We have regularly reported that through our missions and measures. So there's no surprise about that statement, that we have not achieved the level of inspection that we would have hoped to have. On the other hand, we have achieved, together with restaurant owners and operators, a very good food safety record. We've achieved it, in spite of ourselves, you might say, because our plan review, our restaurant relationships, which may be difficult to bear for a small restaurant in an isolated location, but are actually welcomed by the majority of our customers, who send us their plans and ask for help in setting up their work areas to be sure that they have set it up in a way that you're not likely to have contamination from the dishwashing sink into the food prep sink. Most of the states have moved beyond sole dependence on inspections. Inspections play a role to one degree or another depending on the state. But the food safety world has moved beyond a sole reliance on inspections and has complemented inspections with implementation of management safety systems, which are like Six Sigma systems. They're like total quality management systems. They're like the ISO series. They use the same systematic institutionalized approach to managing to achieve a result as is being used throughout the safety world. And that's what we're talking about implementing.
Senator Lincoln and Senator Taylor?
I'll follow up, Chair, later, because we're going to hold the bill. But I need some help with this, and Mary is taking notes back there.
Go ahead, Senator Lincoln.
Well, first of all, I just want to point out to Senator Taylor that I'm pleased to hear that the past administration did such a great job on good training, plan review, that the food safety protection was at its best, and that thanks to the previous administration for doing that. Mr. Chairman,
is that touché?
I was just making a statement, Chairman.
The Democrats don't use French anymore, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me for interrupting. Go ahead, Senator Lincoln.
I'm not expecting a response right now because we are holding this over, but as you started your list of things that you would like to see, I also have... I was glad that you asked for the list or the cost that we're receiving. Both the income and the costs for conducting this business. But I'd like to have the list of the first and second class boroughs that we're talking about. And also, I'd like to hear the next round, not today, but the next round, if some should opt out, some should remain with the state, that how the effective date is in 4 months, that how do you plan, Commissioner, for such a good planner you are, but how would you ever plan in 4 months to know who's going to opt in, who's going to opt out, how many staff you retain, how many you're able to let go because the boroughs are going to assume some of these functions? I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. And the state, I'm still terribly confused about how we have a zero fiscal note and how we move that. I guess that's what I need to know, of the restaurant fees and the other fees for the aquatic farm products. I'm not sure if there's fees there and how that moves over, and if that's enough, and also the liability question that is still on my mind. So those are some of the questions, Mr. Chairman, that I'm not expecting the commissioner to give us today, but maybe on later her day. List. Yeah.
Okay. Senator Lincoln, through the chair, thank you for the comment.
Senator about Taylor. Prior administration?
No, about my skill in planning.
All right, we're through the complimentary right. stage. It's Senator Taylor's turn.
Well, I can be complimentary too.
Okay, give it a try.
I really congratulate the Knowles administration on driving the fees so far through the roof that everybody was in here screaming because they weren't getting any inspections, and they did run a system that didn't have any inspections, and they did it pretty good, I think. But that's the restaurateurs that should be congratulated. But I had a question for the commissioner, and that was that it's my recollection that this system of public health inspection, especially as concerns restaurants, used to be done by a cadre of people who actually lived in our communities. Ketchikan had the wonderful services of a gentleman named Earl May for years. And Earl would get on the ferry, because, of course, it operated in those days, you could count on it. He'd get on the ferry, and he would go to Wrangell and to Petersburg and over to Sitka and hit places like Craig and Klawock, and then he'd go back to Ketchikan. And he didn't do just one inspection per year. I can remember several times where Earl came through Wrangell, and every time he came through, he inspected every bar, inspected every restaurant, went up to the schools on the hot lunch program, and he would do all that in a day or two and gave us great service, and a lot of times, 3-4 times a year. Mm-hmm. And yet, once we moved everything into DEC and we got rid of our public health people, all of a sudden, we didn't have anybody doing that service for us, and the only way you could get it done was to have somebody fly out of Juneau. And as a consequence, there was lots of complaints when the fees went up because they were never seeing any inspectors. And I'm kind of wondering why we shouldn't go back to a similar system.
Senator Taylor, through the chair, we still do. We may not have the level of service that you remember from the days before the transfer of these responsibilities to DEC, but we have, I think there's about 15 of our 35 staff are actually in remote offices, and they are in 20 different locations. Mm-hmm. So we are still, and we do still have food safety staff stationed in Ketchikan, mm-hmm. and we do still provide in-service, in-bar inspection and consultation services. A number of things have happened in the years since the time of your recollection there. One is the number of establishments has proliferated along with the national trend of eating out. People simply eat out a lot more, and there are a lot more places to do it. And the other is a consistent and persistent trend of reducing state administrative budgets everywhere. The level of service that all state programs used to offer is not available any longer. The budgets simply don't allow it. A number of years ago, without regard to which administration it would have been in, because I'm not sure, but a number of years ago, the department implemented a risk-based prioritization of inspection planning so that those establishments that were handling the broadest spectrum of food and the most complex food preparation were the targets for the most regular inspections, and the most frequent inspection hoped for would be for a year. As we have reported consistently in missions and measures, we simply have not been able to achieve that, even with the present fee schedule, again, without regard to which administration it was implemented in. That is driving us to believe that we must reorganize this program, that it is a responsible matter of the executive branch of government to reorganize the program. We must no longer pretend that we can deliver the program as it's designed. We're not making it.
No, I understand.
So it's time to reorganize it, but all is not gloom and doom, because in the meantime, restaurant owners and the Food and Drug Administration and state governments have figured out better ways, or at least equally as good ways, to communicate the principles, starting with hand washing. I mean, everybody is now familiar with mandatory hand washing signs in bathrooms. That's, 10, 15 years that's been, not 25 years ago. Hand washing alone. If we could get every employee to wash their hands before going back to work, we could reduce the incidence of foodborne illness. That's not something a one-time-a-year inspection is going to improve. That has to be operator accountability.
Just as a follow-up, are the people now doing responsible for doing these? Are they cross-trained within your department? And as an example, I know you've got DEC personnel in Sitka, and you've got them in Ketchikan, and here in town. But I mean, is that DEC personnel, is he compartmentalized, or she, to the place where she worries about cruise ships? And she worries about this hydraulic spill at this gravel pit, and that's her job. But it's somebody else's job to go check out the restaurant, and it's somebody else's job to... I mean, is there cross-training there, and is this going to impact your overall mission by losing some of these personnel, or by having someone else take that over?
Senator Taylor, through the chair, we have done extensive cross-training in the Environmental Health Department, so that where we used to have a separate food processing group and food management group, and they're all cross-trained now.
Good. Good. Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And this is maybe a follow-up to, I'm following up a question that Senator Stevens had asked earlier. He asked you if what you were trying to accomplish was transfer of seafood inspections also. And I've gone to grab the statute books here, but you say that provide for inspections under 1720.005 through 1720.075. I mean, that includes labeling and advertisement of halibut, salmon, and sablefish products, misbranding of halibut, sale and labeling of frozen meat and fish, the HACCP provisions under section 1720.065. I mean, there are a lot of seafood processing components that are included in 1720.005 through 075.
Senator Elton, through the chair, if you go to the end of the chapter, if you go to 775, you will see where it gives Commissioner Ballard the authority to... She may delegate sections or may not. So we will have the authority or the ability to kind of pick and choose what things people are and what things people would like us to delegate. But that's an exact copy of the ability we'd already given to first and second class cities. So we're just trying to be consistent in what authority we already have the ability to delegate. It doesn't mean by any means that we would delegate all of that, and I don't think we have any plans to necessarily. We haven't heard from anybody wanting to do that. And we also only have the authority in our food code to delegate. We don't have the authority to delegate our seafood processing code at this time, although if at some point someone wants to do that, we can look at doing it. But at this point, it was just food inspections that we were considering.
This may be, Mr. Chair, something I'd want to have Mary follow up on. If, in fact, you don't plan on doing it, why are you authorizing it to be done?
Wait, check, so they got something to work with.
Any further questions? Well, thank everybody for the questions and the answers, we're going to set this aside and hold it over for a later date.
Mr. Chairman.
If you can get that information back to me, I'd appreciate it.
Appreciate the commissioner's time and the department taking the time to provide us with this option.
Yeah.
If you're, when you're ready to move the bill, let me know.
It's a lively discussion. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Off the cuff, I really hate potlucks. I wonder if we could include potlucks in this outlaw. Church potlucks, no. It's an interesting, I mean, there isn't an awful lot about restaurants, but there's an awful lot about seafood.
Well, that certainly thinned down the crowd. Next item before us is Senate Bill 136, property tax exemption. Mary, we'll turn the...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mary Jackson. I'm staff to Chair Senator Tom Wagner and this committee. You have before you Senate Bill 136. Essentially, this bill does one thing. It increases the existing property tax exemption of $10,000 to $50,000. The $10,000 exemption has been on the books since 1974, almost 30 years. Mr. Chairman, there are two fiscal notes on this. One of them is a zero note from the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. And the second note I just passed out to you is a note from the Tax Division. And I must tell you, is I had a conversation with the people from the Tax Division, and I believe this is an incorrect fiscal note. There is another one floating somewhere in the system. I'm sorry, Senator, I just put it right on top, and I circled it in blue.
Got it.
Okay. And I just point that out for you. I know, Mr. Chairman, that it was not your intent to act on this bill today, so we'll have the most recent fiscal note, I believe, will be available. But it was not available on my email when we came down here this morning, and the only reason, or excuse me, this afternoon, and the only reason I'm aware that there's another one out there was I did speak with the tax assessor, and he is, in fact, online. But the gist of this is very straightforward. The state of Alaska Tax Division presumes that if this up to $50,000 exemptions were provided, that those five entities that are listed would in fact take advantage of it, and that would in turn reduce the revenues to the state of Alaska. And our contention, and this is speaking on behalf of the Kenai Peninsula Borough, if you look at the last table that was provided to you, you'll see that the Kenai Peninsula Borough collects a sales tax. And we're the only ones that do, and we recognize that, but the Kenai Peninsula Borough offsets their property taxes in part because we have a $14 million sales tax. And what struck me as a resident of the Kenai Peninsula Borough was it was an interesting thing to me in that I and the chairman and all of our friends and neighbors pay this sales tax. And in by paying personally a sales tax, we're helping the state of Alaska because we're not reducing the revenues to the state. And I found that very interesting. So it in that regard, then it seems to me that the least he could do is authorize an up to $50,000 exemption for those that do take care of it alternatively. It's a straightforward proposition. It's not the first time that you have had this in front of you. And as I said before, the state assessor is online to answer any questions.
Senator Lincoln.
Mr. Chairman, I've got to leave in a couple of minutes, and so I apologize for just jumping in to ask the question first. But, Mary, I really do appreciate your work on this, and I know that you really feel strongly about this, and I imagine for the Kenai that a number of people probably would. And I'm for also allowing property exemptions up to whatever that the borough or the city would allow. And usually it's folks that are, no, I shouldn't, I'm going to back off of that comment. But what concerns me is that who does this exemption really help? Is it, it will be those that are the property owners, the primary place of residence. And the individuals that can least afford it, that may still be paying a sales, well, would be paying a sales tax. If there's a sales tax, everybody pays that, regardless of whether you're poor or rich. But the poor, or those that can least afford it, are the ones that really don't take advantage of the exemptions, because they're usually the renters. And so they're still paying a sales tax, but they don't get any benefit from these exemptions, even though they're paying for rent, and subsequently they are paying for the property tax through that. So I'm really concerned that that the poor are the ones that end up suffering for something like this as well. And then secondly, that if you have somebody, I mean, if it's a $10,000 assessed exemption now and we increase it to $50,000, I would imagine that there would be many, many property owners that would say, hey, I want the maximum $50,000 and I want it on the ballot. And I wonder if this doesn't force those who would, the other four, that would not want that $50,000 exemption, that it forces them to do that through this legislation.
Certainly, through the chair, Senator Lincoln. Two questions. One was the issue of the costs, if you will, for people. And you are certainly correct. Sales taxes across the board, whereas not everyone can own property, but this state we do have the rental rebate program, and so there is some offset for that. And it is not a lot, but I do recognize your point. The other question is, the other boroughs would probably utilize this program, and I'm sure you're correct. From the perspective of the Kenai Peninsula Borough, who in fact were the ones that requested that this legislation be put forward, I'm sure they wouldn't object to this just being a single purpose legislation that would only affect the Kenai Peninsula Borough. I'm not quite sure how to authorize that. Perhaps something that, except for those entities that provide a sales tax.
Senator Taylor?
Yeah, is this right that you're only at 6.5 mil?
Through the chair, that's correct, sir.
And what is the percent of sales tax?
Through the chair, we are at a 5% sales tax.
The borough's at 2.
Yeah, but by the time you combine them, it makes 5.
Is that right? There's some areas that are higher than 5. I think there's some that are 5.5 to 6.
Barely, yeah.
I want to move to the Kenai.
Well, I'm currently paying 10 or 11 mils and 7% sales tax, and we need every bit of that revenue to operate the city. And I'm assuming that you guys need the revenue that you're generating of $40 million on property tax, and then you've got $14 million more, so you got a $54 million budget, not counting municipal assistance, revenue sharing, federal funds, that kind of stuff. But ballpark, about a $60 million budget probably, or better. All you're going to do is shift within your tax frame. Same level of income has to come in to keep everything going.
Right.
So if you exempt everybody's property that owns property out there and pays property taxes by $50,000, what does that do to the amount of total property tax revenues collected? Any idea?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, Senator Taylor, there would be reductions across the board. You are correct. Somewhere, if there is a reduction in a property tax, there would be an increase in either a sales tax or a decrease in a service that was offered.
It wouldn't be any increase in sales taxes. The sales tax is going to be generated by the economy. So whatever your economy does, that's what your sales taxes are going to be. But it would be a decrease in your total taxable base.
Yes.
Which means that, I don't know what happens if you take $40,000 off the value of every property. I mean, who knows what the property's average out there, but if the property's, averaged $240,000, and that's what your tax base was based on, and you dropped it by an additional $40,000, what percentage would that be of loss of sale of property tax revenues? And since you can't you can only change that by increasing your sales tax to make up for the difference, and maybe that's the way you guys want to go out there, but you could do exactly the same thing by just increasing your sales tax and dropping yourselves a mill. I mean, and that's all local decisions.
Through the chair, Senator Taylor, you're correct, and there is actually someone online from the Kenai Peninsula Borough, and they have talked about this. And unfortunately, there was also supposed to be another document that gave you the information on what were specifics to the borough. It did not come in yet, but as the chair said, he intended to hold this over so we have more time to get more information for you as well.
Because it just seemed to me if you dropped everybody's evaluation by $50,000 and you needed to have the same level of income the next year, what's going to happen is your mill rate's just going to go to 7 instead of 6.5, because you're still going to have the same number of dollars. And what bothers me about the principle is that to the extent you're allowed under this to exempt, I guarantee you, you're going to see the North Slope Borough take full advantage of that. And at $199 million of income coming in up there annually, and they can exempt all of their properties, and what they'll probably do is exempt all residential properties, and they won't exempt anything out there on an oil rig. It's just going to mean that, and I don't know how it plays out as far as what the impact of that is on our educational formula that requires a minimum payment of 4 mils. I'm not sure how that all would equate. I think it doesn't affect it, but I'm not sure. But it does when it gets up there.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, I did ask that question of the Department of Education, and Eddie Jean said it would not have an effect because it's optional. And I did ask, and this was like...
Because for them, it's either or.
Right.
For all the rest of it. For everybody else in the state, it's a mandated 4 mils. For them, it's 4 mils or 30%, whichever is less.
Right. And for state assessor, who is online again, when my conversation with him earlier was, and this is what's supposed to be the new fiscal note that I didn't get, is the information was their assumption was the same as what you had said, Senator Taylor, which is that Fairbanks would probably increase it, and that was about a $625,000 projected decline. Kenai's was $700,000. The North Slope was about $143,000, and Valdez was $475,000. A total of about $1.9 million projected if everybody went ahead and did that. And frankly, that has been the dilemma, if you will, in this proposed exemption all along, and every time that it has been brought up, it's done that. Again, the issue was that the Kenai Peninsula Borough would like to have another tool in their belt that gives them the option. The Kenai Peninsula Borough has stood right there and provides the sales tax in addition to the tax, the property tax. Through the chair, Senator Taylor, the 6.5 mils that are shown there, I might say, is just the flat borough rate. There are additions to that for the service areas.
Additional questions? Senator Elton?
Just real quickly, and then I've got a 3 o'clock meeting too, Mr. Chair, but Mary, I hope
you're going to be a little late.
Thank you. I know it sounds awful. I'm not that bad.
It's almost painful. I'm just going to sit through this. I had heard, it may have been Senator Lincoln that had used this, that it's primary residence, but it's not. It's you can't distinguish between vacation property, for example, residential property, or owner-occupied residential property under this, can you? It's you can?
Yeah, you can, yeah.
So the borough can say right. owner-occupied
mm-hmm. doing it now.
Up to 50,000.
That's specifically what they do right now, and this wouldn't change that.
But we're doing it right now under a senior exemption. It has to be your primary residence. A senior at age 65 can't own two or three different residences and then pick the one that he wants to apply it to.
Up to so much.
Yeah.
Because this bill says exempt residential property. So you can, the borough that can then make a distinction between owner-occupied or vacation. Okay.
Through the chair, if I may, Senator Elton, it's on line 8 for any one residence.
Okay, thanks.
Well, we're going to hold this over, and we're holding a lot of stuff
Mr.
over.
Mr. Chairman, you have people online for this.
Yeah. That's the end of the questions for Mary, though? Okay. Now, who have we got online here?
Gary Superman.
Gary Superman? You there, Gary?
Personally and individually, I've been behind.